Right, good morning. Welcome to the Web Society Annual Meeting for 2018. Those of you who've been here before know what the setup is. We're going to just get through a little bit of business before we get to the really interesting stuff. We've got Steve Rayner and James Runfrey are coming to give us some reports later. Owen wants to say something. Surprise, surprise. right, so...
more than one thing.
So I'm not going to hang about very much. I mean, I'll give you... Steve will tell you that the society is doing quite well. We're getting more and more members. Possibly is the fact that we're going electronic, but he'll give you all the figures. One thing we do seem to be doing is being short of material, which is the usual annual plea, so anybody who does have any observations, drawings, photographs, whatever, CCD images, please contact Owen or James for the website and see if we can generate some more input for the DSO. Right, so I'm going to hand over to Steve, who's waiting in the wings here. And you probably want that one. Yes, that's that one there. Right. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you. Right.
Right. Run through this very quickly. Up to the year, so this is the report we run from 1st of April to 31st of March. So up to the 31st of March last year, we had 219 renewals, 31 resignations / lapses, and that is about 30 lapses and one person who told me. So if you do decide, if you could let me know, I'd really appreciate it. It makes my life so much easier. So we had a few more than last year, but we had 41 new members compared to 39 the previous year. 9 from the EU, 18 from the UK, and 14 from North America. That's the most new members in a year that I've seen. And in the last 4 years in a row, we've had at least 34 new members. So 34, 15, 39, 16, 40, 17, and 41, 18. And also, importantly, net membership has increased in each of the last 5 years. So plus 2, plus 9, plus 19, plus 15, plus 10. So that is a net increase of about 20%, which I think is pretty bloody good. I'm very pleased with that. It continues to grow this year. We already have 10 new members, including one from China, which I thought, hello, what are they scanning me on? got a bit worried, so I emailed James and said, am I worried about this? Is it okay? And he had a quick look, and it was fine. I had a quick look, it's fine. Got a lovely email back from the guy. And one from Hungary. So I think we've got members in at least 25 countries. So Australia, New Zealand, China now obviously, South Africa, North America and Europe. But as Bob says, what we really do to continue this, you know, because everybody says they love the website, they love what we do, they love the DSO, so we do need more articles. Doesn't matter if you think it's not good, you know, don't worry about that. We want to cater for the right at the very top, i.e. Andrew, to right down the very bottom, i.e. me. So please, if you could send us stuff, I appreciate it. So that just gives you an overview as it's going on year by year by year. And the PDF only, we've now got about one-third of PDF and two-thirds PDF and paper. Mostly people who are already paper want to change to PDF, but we also have some people who started off PDF and a bit like me think, no, I can't do that, so they go over to paper. So a bit of a mixture. And again, the new members, it is a mixture of paper and PDF. It's not purely PDF driven. And the latest stuff, the latest last year, it was more full members joined, new members joined, than just PDF only. So that's good. Boring bit, do apologise about this, this is something we have to do. General Data Protection Regulation. Oh, it's lovely. I had to go on a one-day seminar for the cancer support group that my wife and I are members of. God, that was boring. So it's additional to the Data Protection Act. Please, all of you members, if you see me or see my wife Anita on the front desk, if you can sign a form to say, yes, we can keep your data, I'd really, really appreciate it. It makes my life so much easier. The other thing is, my tesco.net email address is being exterminated. So I now have webdeepsky@gmail.com. Don't need to write that down, it's on the website, so you can go there. But that's what it will be in the future. Treasurer. We're still good. As we expected, we made a loss last year, but it was a special year. But we've got a record income last year from subscriptions and from sales. And interestingly enough, almost just under half of subscription payments now are via the website and via PayPal. So that's one thing that we've done that really has helped us a lot. So, going over there, you can see that to print the DSO cost us last year £1,400, but the postage was £1,550. And interestingly enough, that postage was only for 3 editions. So that tells you how much it costs us twice as much to post to Australia as it does to print the magazine. Postage costs are horrendous. So we then have preparations of items for sale, i.e. printing books and what have you, £2,000. The AGM cost, catering speakers for £1,500. Committee expenses, £232. My expenses, postage, paper, ink, etc., etc., £230. We went to the International Astronomy Show last year. We went to the BAA Deep Sky Society meeting last year. This year. And the Northwest Astronomy Show, which unfortunately Owen and I went to and won't go again, but never mind. So there were 964. Somebody forgot that they had a standing order going through, so when they resigned, they forgot to cancel it. So I had to refund his £18. FES subs and PLI 58, web hosting domain 49. My PayPal here machine threw a wobbler, so we had to buy a new one. So the total expenditure last year was £8,160. Income, subscriptions just under 400. AGM income 940, sales 2,359. We transferred some monies to the charity's account purely as a precaution. I probably didn't need to do it, but I knew there was a lot of expenses and I didn't want us to run short. So the income was £9,230. So then we made £38 on the Virgin account interest and £8 on the charity's account. So we had £9,280. So, start of the year, was just over 3,900 in the Lloyd's account. The income was 9,000, but as I said, 2,000 of that was actually money we already had. Expenditure was 8,100, and so the balance at the end of the year was £5,000. Still have £126 as cash flow for exhibitions. Virgin account started at 775, 38.93 added, ended at 7.8. Charity's account was 5,003, £8 interest, 2,000 transfers, gives us 3,300. So, as I said, we made about a loss of about £1,000, but that was, in my opinion, money very well spent. We also have a North American section, we used to have an Australia, Southern section, but that is now defunct. So we had 72 members, now total, 13 new, and 5 lapsed stroke resigned. And the North America, the balance at the beginning of last year was 171, income of 1,600. Their income has dropped a lot because I have a lot of North American members who now pay by the website. So, but never mind. So there was 907 subscriptions, 150 sales, and I transferred some money to them because we then spent £1,600 on Wilman Bell books. So their balance at the end of the year was $106.87. That's it. Any questions?
That's a for sale. £10.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. Right.
Well, can I just ask somebody to propose that we accept Steve's report as treasurer?
I can't. Can I?
Sorry, name?
James Clark.
All right, thank you. And a seconder? Yes? Peter. Right, okay. Thank you. Right. I'll hand over to James and we'll talk about the website. Thanks, James.
Okay. First of all, and probably most importantly, is I'd just like to point out we're using Google Analytics now, and I have a 4 year of data. Remember, this time last year I just swapped over to using Google Analytics and only had a couple of months' worth of data. We now have a 4 year, as you can see, but to give me time to prepare, it runs from mid-May to mid-May at the moment, this information. And it's really just telling us where the people are logging in from, and this is telling us where people are logging in from in terms of the sessions is, they go come along, browse the site for a little while, but also we can identify how many users that represents as well in percentage terms. I haven't bothered with the actual numbers on here. I've got them written down if anyone wants them, but we're talking about roughly users in the last year, probably just about 4,000. You can see that session-wise, we're actually getting the UK is top, North America fairly close behind, Europe ex-UK is pretty close as well, and the rest of the world makes up that 11%. But we are getting quite a lot of coverage from all over the place. As Steve said, we are getting new members coming in from all over the place, but obviously some of this is not just scams or spam or whatever. They are actually looking at our site. Users, interestingly, reverses. They're actually more Americans looking at the site, but they're probably spending fewer sessions on the site than we do in the UK. But certainly I'm seeing a growth in certainly North America, but other parts of the world as well. And I think that slowly is probably getting reflected in some of the membership figures that Steve presented. So we are actually, we're covering quite a lot of the globe, although there is an Antarctica on there, but never mind. What are they actually doing, or where are they coming from? They're finding us still, and I think this has been the case since I took over the website, it's all probably always been the case. Most of them are coming via one of the search engines or directly they've got a bookmark saved. You can see how much that actually is on the organic search portion of the pie chart. Direct is a little bit, but that little leftover is interesting to some degree. We're getting a little bit more from social media, that's mainly Facebook. And Facebook does seem to be providing some, should we say, genuine interest. There do seem to be more astronomers on there that, rather than our South American following that we've had for a long time. I'm seeing a lot more, far more indications that we are getting people who are genuine astronomers coming and having a look at our stuff. And sometimes they're following the links as well to the website. And we're getting quite a few referrals as well, which is from other websites that have got links on to our site, and people are coming that way. Those are the overall figures, not broken down. As you can see, we have a huge number of users, 7,000 in the year, 13,500-ish sessions, looking at 34,000 page views. So you can see that that's about 2.5 pages. That's been pretty constant over the last few years, not much change. And the session duration hasn't changed too much at around about 2.5 minutes as well that people spend on our site, which is actually quite a long time. So I'm hoping that this is, I'm not seeing very many of those sessions where it's that they spent half an hour on our website, which kind of suggests that they just left the web page open for lunch. And I'm not seeing quite so many that are just the 5 seconds, 10 seconds, which is they come, they bounce, they go straight away again. At 2 minutes, they're probably actually reading things and looking through things. And that's also helped by the number of pages that they're looking at. And what are they looking at? Well, looking at breaking down that page, those page views, there's a fair number just go to the home page. And that's not a huge surprise because that's fairly common in any website. We're drawing in quite a few to look at our publications, but I don't know what the actual what the sales are like through the website in terms of publications, but at least it's making people aware. We haven't got a, basically, as I'm sure you're aware, we haven't got a full web sales publications online. You have to contact us and do the thing through email. Double stars and the galaxies are pulling in a fair number of people. Nebulae clusters a few less because we don't have a lot of content on there. It's, I don't know whether you're familiar, but on double stars we have double star of the month, we have galaxy of the month. We don't have a similar thing for nebulae clusters. And I am noting that looking at what people are actually looking at, what people are looking for and the links they click on, there are more and more, especially in the US, that are actually following links, search results that are for specific objects. So because it's on our website, they're following, they're reading about that specific object, maybe looking at some of your observations that are up there for that object, and then hopefully drifting off to other things as well. Membership then gets about 3%, but I don't think that's particularly unusual, and we are getting through to a few more people. So, unless there are any particular questions, I think that's pretty much all I wanted to say about the website, other than it's now secure. The migration that I was going to do to the new server, which gives you the secure link in the web bar, is now finished, and it seems to work fine at the moment. The solution we've got also doesn't cost us any more money because I migrated the server at the same time. But we do have something to discuss about the Yahoo discussion group or alternatives that Owen wants to talk about, which has come up because of changes at Yahoo mainly.
Thanks very much, James.
Okay, so briefly, and I suspect I'm going to get blank looks from almost everybody here, we have a web society group on Yahoo that maybe 30% of the committees are on, and a few other people, which is somewhat embarrassing. Unfortunately, the Yahoo group has been having trouble with Yahoo itself. We had a period of 2 weeks where neither James or I could access it. There was nothing that we could do about it. And this is not unusual for Yahoo groups. On top of that, Yahoo appeared to have changed their terms and conditions, which basically says anything you put on it belongs to them, which of course none of us are particularly happy about. So we had an idea, and a number of other societies are moving to an alternative thing called groups.io, and we were going to ask if people thought, I mean, there's, we only wanted Steve here for this one, but I could automatically move the Yahoo group to groups.io. There may be GDPR things in that, because we're obviously moving membership around, and I probably should have done it before the 28th of May, or whenever it came in. But would people, or those people in here who use that, we've got really two options. We can move to another groups that basically has the same functionality as Yahoo groups, or, and this isn't necessarily James and I's preferred option, we could move to a web forum-based thing, a bit like the BAA has. There are a number of reasons why we don't want to do that unless we get some help. One is it would require a lot more administration, and neither James or I have the skills, or necessarily in my case the time, to look after that. And secondly, most of these forums are what we call pulls, so you've got to log on and have a look and see what's going on. So what would people feel? Of those people who use the groups, website groups, do people think that perhaps we just move to groups.io and carry on with the same functionality, or would people think that we should look at a more of a forum-based one?
Is there any negative side to moving to the IO compared to the Yahoo group? Is there anything that it doesn't offer? Or
no, it's pretty much, it looks to me pretty much the same. My idea was that I could get random images put up on a forum and see how quickly you might get wound up. and if you didn't get one, I'd start taking crappy images and put them up as well, just to make it that way.
Well, if there's no problem with the IO group, it performs what the Yahoo group does with the problems and conditions of the Yahoo group, it seems a no-brainer, really.
Okay, I'll look into doing that. There will, everybody who's on the web group would get an email once it's migrated telling you what to do. I don't know whether you would necessarily need to become a member of groups.io to post, but I will follow through that and
Is it worth asking the board what people think in the audience rather than just...
How many people actually use the web Society in Britain? Yeah, that's what I thought. As I said, 30% of the committee don't even...
I would use it more, but Yahoo hates me, so...
So, okay, well, in which case I'll look at managergroups.io. Theoretically, it's a fairly clean move.
I suppose the other question is, are there any people here who feel that they would get more involved if it was a web forum rather than an email basis?
And the other thing that we perhaps could mention, and this is aimed at Andrew and Stuart, is perhaps we could have a planetary nebula of the month or something. I mean, you've got 96 in the NGCIC, so that keeps you going for a few years.
Yeah.
and that might get some more traffic onto the page.
I mean, going back to the stats you were just mentioning a minute ago,
yeah.
I mean, with the... You know, so the Yahoo group as an example. I mean, okay, you've flippantly said the committee, you know, sort of people are using it. But what about sort of the worldwide trend? Like you say, you know, because of the users in America and all that. Trying to get the group that
way. Strange thing, I mean, people like Sue French on it, surprisingly. So she'll come in on double star stuff, and I have to take it off there, ask Bob, and then repost. So people do ask questions about double stars and things on there. So people in America, it's advertised off the web page, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, so there is a link to the Yahoo group, but of course we don't get good stats because it's hosted by Yahoo. So there's no good way.
I mean, it tends to be pulsing, and you'll get nothing for a month, and then you'll get a Paul Briley, and then you'll get nothing for.
I mean, going on about what you said about the web forum, does that mean it would be a continuation of, let's say, the web page, you know, i.e. the website itself?
If you were going to a forum, it would probably end up being something,
because then it's more integrated.
It wouldn't be integrated quite the same way. It'd probably be something more like, you see, with Stargazer's Lounge Cloud Unites, that kind of forum.
Norwich Society have got the web page, you know, like ours, and they have a forum on it.
Yeah.
And the only difference is to click on the forum, you've got to sign in as a member, you know, so it doesn't...
Well,
so
you
generally,
have the
look at
the
thing, all the members can sign in.
You have to do that on ours as well, or any forum, to stop random...
But the look in the field would be more like that than an email.
We would have to pay for a proper hosted service. I mean, not something we'd have to look at getting more.
Yeah. What the NES one does on the front page is it's got the last three posts down the right hand side. You can't click into and read them in full. It's just got the heading and whatever.
Yeah, that's just so people can post. They can see the horse over the binoculars. You know what that's like.
I mean, the
advantage of the forum is that we could have multiple fora on it. We could have a web society admin forum to let you know about meetings and changes. There could be discussion forums. So, whereas the group is just an everything on its own.
The real question is, again, it's one of participation, isn't it? Because some people prefer to just like the email system, the email group system, and they don't want to have to go online all the time to do the whole forum thing. And if we were going to go and do a forum, it's enough work that you'd be thinking you don't really want to commit to that and the extra cost if there's not going to be a great deal of participation.
And there are lots of extra forums out there. If there's a system that already does it, use that rather than create extra work.
We'll just move it across to groups.io. I got some fairly positive stuff from Phyllis and some of the US people about that one. So I have that one when John's in Wales and hasn't got a sheet to play with if you know after a forum.
I mean, something we could revisit if suddenly it looks like there's a great deal of enthusiasm for it. But
okay.
Keep it simple.
Yep, thank you.
Are there any other questions?
I think the other aspects of this might be one method or another might possibly attract some further membership. If you get a genuine discussion about it, could generate further membership. So, that's something to just think about.
Well, I suspect what we'll do...
Rather than just thinking how many of the current members use it.
Well, what we'll do then is we'll move to groups.io immediately, as soon as I can get that working, and then we can put some more thought into the forum and throw that up on the
at the lists and what have you, and see where we go from there. I mean, it would in some ways be nice to have a forum where you could split things, but it does take some admin. So if anyone's volunteering.
we do have somebody who said that they'd be willing to help out one of our Italian members who runs that one of their national forums said that he would help out on that if he decided to do that. But again, it's nothing sadder than the forum with nothing happening.
But would it be worth putting something out on the webpage, because we're not really a representative number of members?
No, exactly.
And you might get a sort of vote towards the forum from the members, which would then make it worthwhile doing.
We could then, we could look at the idea of, again, we talked to Steve about it, whether we can send something around like just a web server. It needs to be one or two questions, yes or no.
So we'd need to see what was on his form, because
right.
You on GDPR you do need to have would you mind being contacted by email? Again, if we'd been sensible, we should have reacted before the 28th of May and got all this done before that mess started.
So it might be worth putting into the wider membership, but we're going to have to talk about that, how we actually do it without being illegal.
Right. Okay, thank you. Thanks, James. Thanks, Owen.
Just a quickie. When I go to download the PDF magazine, I'm asked to log in.
No, essentially what you do that page will get you, because it doesn't set a cookie perspective. So if you notice, even if you do it from the download screen, you do page out, if you go back and then come back, you get log in again.
Okay, thanks very much. We've got one more matter of business to transact before we finish the business meeting, and that is the election of officers. Everybody is willing to stand again, apart from Andrew Robertson, who's decided he wants to take a break from it. So can we give Andrew a vote of thanks for the work he's done in the last few years? And as far as I know, everybody else is willing to stand, so can we just usually do the usual thing and vote everybody else in en bloc, unless anybody is willing to take Andrew's place on the committee? No. Right. Okay. Well, if you are, if you think about it, talk to me later about it anyway. We can discuss it. But I say all the other officers are willing to stand, so can we have a proposal that we maintain the officers again, please? Yes, thank you. Okay. Is that seconded? Thank you. Right, well that concludes the business part of the meeting, and so we now move on to the programme of talks.
Rob,
sorry.
Before we just sign off, although we have deservedly thanked Andrew, can you record the members' thanks to the whole of the committee for their work over the last year?
Right, thank you, Peter. Yes, right, okay. Right, if you just bear with me, I shall just... Right, well I can see our first speaker is here. We're delighted to welcome today Omar Nazim from the University of Regensburg. Omar is the professor in the history of science there, and his work focuses the scientific practice and techniques surrounding observations such as drawing and note-taking. In 2013 he wrote Observing by Hand, Sketching the Nebulae in the 19th Century, which discusses the links between drawing, seeing and knowing. So on several levels, this is a talk that should chime with interests of the society. So I'm delighted to invite Omar to give his talk, which is entitled Drawing the Nebulae in the 19th Century, Points of Entry into the Wider Cosmos. Omar.
Thank you very much, Bob. Hello, everybody. I'm quite happy to be here. To share this material with you. It's material that I've already published on in a book, as Bob just mentioned, that appeared at the end of 2013. So now, basically, instead of drawings, I'm working on a book, currently on a book on photography and astronomy, so astrophotography. But I'll touch on that in the end. Today, I'm going to be going through some interesting aspects of drawing in astronomy and the history of this practice. But before we do that, we need to begin here with this image by Hubble of Orion, as many of you are obviously quite familiar with it. This is what we associate with visualization imaging today in astronomy. And as you can see here, it's a pretty picture. In another time, in another place, specifically the 19th century, these are more than just pretty pictures. And here we have a drawing of the same object by George Bond at the Harvard College Observatory. This is from about the 1840s. And these things were beginning to be drawn, the nebula in particular, prolifically throughout the 19th century by a number of major astronomical observers. Not only Bond, but people like John Herschel, Lord Rosse, and others that we'll be discussing in due course. What I want to emphasize here is that these things were published widely and absorbed into culture quite widely. As a matter of fact, I believe that this is M51. It's actually Van Gogh was quite familiar with this image through the French popularizer named Camille Flammarion and his work. These drawings were absorbed into a larger culture, were available to a larger culture, and hundreds of them were made. They were made using some of the state-of-the-art telescopes of the 19th century, some of the largest, including what we have here is Lord Rosse's giant Leviathan of a telescope. And here we have, this is basically the earlier version, but it's what John Herschel would have later employed as well. Now, these practices of drawing the nebulae have themselves a history that goes a bit further back than the 19th century. Here we're already in the 18th century with William Herschel, with his telescope, and he's producing these drawings of the nebulae in the 1780s. Now, again, they're playing a very specific role within the astronomical research program of Herschel. He's able to increase the numbers of the nebulae cataloged dramatically. By the time he's done, we have nearly 2,500 nebulae. When he started, we knew about 114 with the Messier objects. But these drawings go even further back in history. By the way, this is Herschel's image of the Orion Nebula. These are also earlier images of Orion by various French astronomers of the 18th century, and of the 17th century. The earliest drawing of the Orion Nebula is here, published in 1654 by the French astronomer Hodrina. Now, it's very tempting here to think that these images are basically meant to popularize meant to propagate, meant to sort of indulge a larger public. But I want to show you today that actually the practice of drawing these things themselves was a part of the research. That actually engaging in the drawing itself was an activation of certain forms of detailed attention and observation. In other words, the drawings themselves were integral to observing these very fragile, very difficult, famously difficult objects to observe, especially with the means given. So what is going on here is more than just pretty pictures. And that's what I'm going to try showing you. And we're going to start with this quotation by John Herschel, who said, "It would manifestly be impossible by verbal description to give any just idea of the capricious forms and irregular gradations of light affected by the different branches and appendages of this nebula, that is, the Orion. In this respect, the figure must speak for itself, nor is it easy for language to convey a full impression of the beauty and sublimity of the spectacle it offers when viewed in a sweep, justifying expressions which, though I find them written in my journal, in the excitement of the moment, would be thought extravagant if transferred to these pages." The key idea here is that language, at this moment, is not sufficient to convey the research and what they're seeing with regards to these nebulae. They didn't know what they're looking at. These were still extremely strange objects. We have to put ourselves back into their shoes. As a historian, that's what I try to do. And see the world from their perspective. And once we do that, we begin to appreciate, again, the fact that because language was insufficient, they had to rely on images to fully express as much as possible what they saw. And that to an astronomical community. In other words, these were the results, these images were the results of long, detailed observations and were meant to be shared within the astronomical community as the cutting edge, latest research results for that community on a very mysterious, strange, new kind of object. So the strangeness of these things is something we need to first appreciate. To do that, let's go into the notebooks, the observing books. And I'm going to begin with Lord Rosse's research program. As many of you probably know, this is the giant telescope that Lord Rosse built for himself what is now the backyard of the castle in Burke County in Ireland. It is huge. And what I'm interested in, it, by the way, it was built in the 1840s. And what I'm interested in is what happens here at this very conjunction between, this is the platform where the notebook would be seated or placed, and this is the eyepiece, obviously. And there will be a lantern here of some sort or other. Previously, we didn't actually know what kind of lighting that they used. Some had suggested, actually, that they might have used a piece of coal, or different pieces of coal because of the orange color. But then we actually discovered a lantern in Lord Rosse's basement, the current Lord Rosse, in the castle. And what's interesting is they, on that lantern, they use an orange filter already in the 1840s, 50s. Now, this is what I'm interested in. What happens here? What's going on there is heavily reliant on a series of notebooks. Let's look at this one.
This one here is from 1848, from the Lord Ross Archives. And if we open it, we find a bunch of notes, as you would expect, on different objects. Here's Messier 99, another Messier object here. This is a Herschel number object, another Messier. But what's really astounding is also the small little sketches that are being made. These sketches, the majority of them were being made at the telescope, on that platform, in the night, with those lighting conditions. Now, Lord Ross actually had, in the course, the telescope actually had a life of over, it was actively used for about 45 years. And in those 45 years, it was also the largest telescope in the entire world. And he employed many, many assistants. And so each of the assistants that he did employ had their own notebook personalized to them. And what you find is that the drawings, the way in which these assistants drew and the way in which they did take notes on what they saw varied. Here's another notebook. This is from also the same period here. It's by another assistant. You can see the differences in the manner of taking notes, but also in the manner of drawing. Here, a pencil is used in a very smudgy way, if I may say so, to emphasize volume. Here, a pen is used, ink is used, to emphasize structural interests. What I've just said now already begins to hint at the fact that even the materials that they used and the style employed in making these drawings already go far into emphasizing particular interests that they would have had in these nebulae, specifically its volume or its massiness, and its structures. Again, these are, as he says here, a very strange object. They are very strange objects. And the best way they knew how to become acquainted with these objects, to become familiar with these objects, Herschel even calls them my friends. That's the familiarity that they gained, was through drawings, intimate drawings, drawings done night after night after night of the very same object. These are not simple snapshots, not one-time drawings. These are drawings that would occupy assistant after assistant, notebook after notebook, over 40 years of work. And this is what I'm going to try showing you by using this example here. This is what's called H399. H is the old Herschel cataloging number. So this is the old Herschel 399. Today we would call this the NGC 2261. Let's follow it. 1849. This is about February 11th on a Sunday. This is a drawing done by one of the assistants named George Stoney. He becomes himself a scientist, a major scientist in his own right. He actually invents the word, coins the word electron. But right now he's a young man. He's working with Ross in Ireland, and he makes this drawing of 399. This is another drawing of 399 done by another assistant, Samuel Hunter. This is in the 60s, 1860s now. So we are already just under 20 years from the very first drawing you saw. Again, notice the difference in this texture and the style. This is not a coincidence. The idea is that all of these different styles, all these different approaches of the assistants contributed to a better acquaintance with these very strange objects. This is a way to get to know these things. In a way, it's a way to access them observationally in a very detailed way, and I will add, in a very systematic way. Why? Because this is what happens next. These are not the only notebooks. All this work by the assistants over all these years gets then collected into a separate book called The Ledger. Here's all the drawings for this object, starting as early as 48, going all the way up to as late as 63. These are not one-time drawings. These are drawings that take up years of work through many different eyes, but then systematized and brought together on one page. And the drawings that you just saw get copied down as well as the notes. And it's at this point that they begin to consolidate what they've seen with a number of eyes again over a number of years. This is actual astronomical research work, observation, that involves drawings. Again, to access these things in an intimate way. And it's a way to get to know what they're seeing in a detailed way. Now, again, the notebooks themselves have a system. And so then they get collected here. What happens at this point then is the assistants, along with Lord Ross, get together and they have a discussion. They have a meeting. And it's unfortunate for us historians that these guys all actually lived in the same castle. So these meetings, there's no records of these meetings. They would then sit around this ledger, and when they would discuss what is the best way to then represent H399. Because at the end of the day, what they want to do, they want to publish these images. Because these images, again, as Herschel said, they must speak for themselves because our language fails. So what happens is they then decide on the drawing to be published. Sometimes they would select one of the drawings, as in this case. In other cases, they would make composites of the drawings. And then they would make a finished drawing. This is an album of finished drawings. Each one of these objects have years of drawings and notes behind them. They're not snapshots. Not by a long shot. And they have hundreds, sometimes hundreds of pages dedicated to these things before we even get to the stage of final drawings. This is the album of final drawings. And what I mean by that, these are the polished drawings that were meant to go to the engraver. In this case, the engraver would have been someone called James Bessire, who was the official engraver for the Philosophical Transactions, where this stuff would get published. This then is H399, which gets updated. It has a different, some of these actually get updated with newer Herschel numbers, as you can see here. this little card with the Paul's drawing would then be sent to the engraver for publication. And what we have here is the synthesized image, again, that is something that is presented as the latest drawing, latest result of the Ross project. And here, this is what it looks like when it gets published. Oops. Yeah, there's the smaller view, but here's the page. Here's the page where it gets published in the Philstrans. This is from the publication from the 1850s. Here's a closer view. You can see that the smudgy character of the original drawing has been changed into a stippled engraving. Now,
I've just shown you the pathway that these drawings took. I want to just briefly touch on Herschel's most famous, Lord Rosse's most famous object, the one he discovered to be a spiral for the very first time. This is M51, which at that time would have been called H1622. And this is the very first drawing of a spiral, as a spiral, to be recognized as a spiral. And this is the original drawing that was done for publication. Again, I could get into the details of the materials used, because I believe that even the materials used to draw actually reflected a certain interest and objective in capturing something that they wanted to capture about the object. But I want to go into the ledger for this thing. This is the ledger page. There's five of these pages in the ledger just for M51. Years of work and many different forms of drawing. Some dissected forms of drawing, others their explorations. And this is the other point I want to get across here, is that these drawings were exploratory. They were exploring with the pen or the pencil. And you can see this here, for instance. This is a magnified part of this part of the page here. You can see here that they're exploring the possibility that there's another extra arm appendage here. You see that? That would have come from an original drawing in one of the notebooks. This is, again, the ledger where all the drawings were collected. Here's another exploration, again, of the new appendage here. And here we have a little bit of some rudimentary measurements as well. Again, they're using the drawings to explore what they're seeing. It's a tool for observation. And now, the other point that I want to get across is that even when the nebulae, the final, gets published, it doesn't put an end to anything. The Rosse project continues to draw and draw and draw. So even after M51 is first published in 1850 by Rosse, and I showed you the final drawing of it, in the 60s, they're still drawing M51. They're still exploring its features by hand, by drawings. And here you have Hunter's observing book sketches of M51 continuing the exploration of this particular object. And it continues. Here's the earliest known drawing of that object. Here's the second, third, fourth. And this one gets published as late as 1880. It doesn't stop. It doesn't end. They continue to draw and draw and draw. Because what they're interested in is getting to know these things by hand. As a matter of fact, it's an exploration. It's an active research tool, an active exploration that continuously gets going with questions and inquiries. And the more they get into it, see, language fails, literally. Is it this or is it that? Which form is it? And they're asking themselves questions in these notebooks in exactly these kinds of formulae that include drawings. And these are questions to themselves for the next series of observations. These are questions for their colleagues, for the next batch of assistants. Perhaps this or that. Now, I spoke about these drawings as explorations and as being explored by the hand. I want to take this long quotation, but before I get to this quotation, I don't want you to read it, so I'll just put it here, because I know you can start reading it. Let me just say that one thing I'm arguing also is that, and I have argued, is that this idea is not new, okay, to the sciences. Natural historians, biologists, anatomists, people who work with the microscopes of all kinds
all kinds of scientists used drawing for exactly this kind of purpose. That is, as a research tool, as a tool for observing things and becoming more familiar with it. And so the ROS program is exactly in line with this kind of approach to these very strange and difficult and mysterious objects at the time. And it's exactly this that's captured by this quotation by John Ruskin, one of the most important literary aesthetic critics of the 19th century, who wrote, "It is by seizing these leading lines, that is, these lines in drawings, when we cannot seize all, that likeness and expression are given to a portrait, and grace and a kind of vital truth to the rendering of every natural form. I call it vital truth because these chief lines are always expressive of the past history and present action of the thing. They show in a mountain, first, how it was built or heaped up, and secondly, how it now being worn away and from what quarter the wildest storms strike it. In a tree, they show what kind of a fortune it had to endure from its childhood. In a wave or cloud, these leading lines show the run of the tide and of the wind, and the sort of change which the water or vapor is at any moment enduring in its form, as it meets shore or counter wave or melting sunshine. Try always, whenever you look at a form, to see the lines in it which have had the power over its past fate and will have power over its futurity. These are its awful lines." Awful here is the old way of saying awesome. Lines. "See that you seize on those whatever else you miss." He's talking about drawing. And he's talking about the power of drawing to actually, if you capture that line, that expression, you perhaps even capture its history, its future, and the effects on that object that it might have had. And I would claim, and I have claimed, that even the spiral galaxy that Ross discovered was most likely discovered due to the gesture of the spiral when he drew it. It's the leading line. The very gesture of drawing that spiral for the very first time is what helped him to recognize it for the very first time as a spiral. Let's quickly touch on John Herschel. How am I doing on time?
I've got 15.
Okay. So let me just quickly go through Herschel's monographs and his method of drawings, because it shows you that each of these astronomers had their own techniques that were very powerful in their own way. I'm going to look at his drawings that were executed in the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa. That's his telescope set up at the at the Table Mountain there. And I'm going to look at these kinds of drawings, specifically this drawing here, what I call a descriptive map of Orion. Herschel made it earlier in the 20s, he made a drawing like this of the same object. But I want you to notice the differences here, and those are crucial, because I call one a portrait and another a descriptive map. One of the reasons that you will see why I do that is that because this has a very different manner of approaching the object through drawing, and it's done through mathematics. Portraits, we have already seen in Ross, so they're not so mathematically imbued, not so much geometry going on, much more descriptive. In this case, we have much more geometry going on, and I'm going to get into that. Herschel, this drawing took him many nights of observations, and he still wasn't done. He spent 4 years at the Cape. He made drawings of this object night after night as much as he could, and it wasn't even done at the Cape. He brought it back to his home in Slough, outside of London, and there he continued working for the next 10 years on this information that he brought with him. And it's actually in Slough that he finishes this drawing, 10 years after he gets back from the Cape. This is what the Cape stuff looks like. I took the example of what he called, at that time it was called Eta Argus. We would call it Eta Carinae today.
This is what he calls the working skeleton. What he does is he takes a central star, a very conspicuous star, easy to find, and creates a baseline. And from that baseline, he begins to triangulate the distances of all the stars. This is just the skeleton for the drawing. The next step is then to fill the drawing with the nebula. So once he has the triangulation of the stars, and therefore a nice proportion and a nice scale set up, he then begins to draw in a very fine way the nebula. And this is net upper net. So just for this object here, I have discovered at least 21 of these skeleton sheets. Each one has a different kind of entry for this nebula. And what's crucial here to understand is that these lines are not just scaling and creating the proportional image visualization of the nebula. Again, for him, this is a nebula. But it's also anybody here who's ever done drawing knows that when you put it into squares or triangles like this, you're able to pay attention differently. In other words, what he did is that he focused, instead of being overwhelmed, he talks about being overwhelmed by this nebula. I mean, he says almost to despair. Those are his words. It was despairing how much there was to draw. So what he did was he broke it up into parts, and he was guided by these little triangles. So he would focus one night on that triangle, on another night not on that triangle, on another night on that triangle. It was a piecemeal effort that took years of work. Again, why? Why wouldn't he just sort of draw it on one night? Well, it's because this was an observational tool. It was meant, again, to get himself familiar with this thing in a very intimate way. Again, it's a tool of observation. And the result is this. This is the final polished drawing for Edda Carne that will then be used for the engraving. So this is the final drawing. Again, this you can't really tell here because the image quality is bad, but it's actually by pencil. It's extraordinary. And what he did was that he projected some of those skeleton maps onto this piece of paper and then traced his own original drawings, his 21 skeletons, onto this one page. This is the engraving that gets published in 1847 of that object. Now these lines, this entire technique, this is another object, this entire technique is elaborate, and he does this for a dozen of the nebulae that he publishes in 1847 as his grand results of the Cape expedition. And this is basically just skeleton one. You can see that there's an intensity of measurement involved here. There's a micrometrical, he uses two different telescopes to get the different details, a smaller telescope to get the micrometrical measurements, and then the larger telescope to get the actual details of the drawings of the nebula itself. This technique, if you don't know, actually comes from land survey. This is called the chain of triangle technique. So this is actually one way to, we have here German cities being connected in the exact same method that the nebulae drawings were by Herschel. This is a technique that goes back to Snell in the 17th century, but it gets used the most by the imperial powers to be of the 18th and 19th centuries. So this is the and on top of that, Herschel was an amazing draftsman. This is one of his Camera Lucida drawings in his grand tour of Italy. You could see that this is, by the way, his drawing for the Orion Nebula, his skeleton sheet for Orion. You could see the quality of his lines. Lord Rosse also published a drawing of the nebula Orion using skeleton forms inspired by Herschel. So Herschel's techniques also inspired others to make a certain, this is 7 years of work with that one drawing, 7 years of work using skeleton sheets. Again, this is Lord Rosse now. And there's at least five different hands involved here. This gets then also nicely reversed. I guess I should have mentioned before, All these drawings are in the reverse. I assume that you guys knew that. So I'm so sorry. I was late maybe to say that, but the darker it is, it's actually very bright. So when you reverse the images, that's what it looks like. A bit more familiar. And this is, I just want to show you that there's a these things then get reversed and published, and this gets published widely. finally, at around the same time that this work gets published, you have the very first photographs of the Orion Nebula. This is from 1880, September. Henry Draper, his very first successful photograph of the Orion Nebula. Here's another one that he soon acquires. I want to just end off by saying this drawing is an observational tool within the research programs of the leading astronomers of the day. Does not end with photography. Okay, it doesn't. It continues on into the 20th century, deep into the 20th century. Drawing is absolutely essential for astronomers well into the 1950s. And despite there being photography. Why? Because you need to extract the information. This is William Pickering's multi-layer drawing of the Orion Nebula. But it's based upon 21 photographs. What you're seeing here is 21 photographs composited into one map, one drawing. And this idea that drawing is essential even to photography is crucial to understand because photography doesn't just solve everything. And I have examples and cases of this kind of technique continuing well into the 20th century. So photography does not kill drawing, because drawing is absolutely essential in this period before the CCD cameras, before digital photography comes about, to observation itself in astronomy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Omar. Questions? Yes, Andrew.
When they had the Keystone maps, they said 21 stars and all the triangles. He said he had 21 of them. After he did his first one, which obviously took a lot of time, all the star triangles, did he then just replicate that exactly, so then keep adding bits of never the detail? Or did he do new triangulation?
He would do sometimes new triangulation, something like that.
Sometimes
he would baseline to keep adding to it. Exactly. So sometimes he would continue with the same baseline. Other times he would change it up simply because he was not satisfied. He was really, really perfectionist. So you continuously try to adjust the baseline. And when you adjust the baseline, all of the other stuff has to be adjusted again. So yes and no. So sometimes yes, sometimes no. It was really, it's a very practical art.